try, wrap me, rock me, country me to sleep. Just put on Mandarin, or maybe a little, just a little Northern Creole.
All right. Good evening. You're listening to Unceded Airwaves by the Indigenous Collective on CITR 101.9 FM. As always, we are broadcasting from what is now known as Vancouver on the traditional, ancestral, unceded, and current lands of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. And CITR is specifically located on Musqueam territory. My name is Sage. I'm of mixed Sawridge, Cree, and European ancestry. My family is from Treaty 8 territory in Edmonton, but I grew up in Coast Salish territory on Vancouver Island.
Hi, my name is Brandy, and I'm Soto and Cree from Treaty 1 territory. My family is from Pegwas First Nation, although I grew up off-reserve in Winnipeg, and now I go to UBC for what will hopefully be a creative writing degree, hopefully.
Hello, my name is Tiana. I am Anishinaabe from Kisikunin Ojibwe First Nation in Treaty 2 territory, but I grew up off-reserve in Dauphin, Manitoba. I am in my fourth year here at UBC, double majoring in First Nations and Indigenous Studies and English Lit. But yeah.
All right, so tonight's show is exciting for two reasons. The first is that we are discussing Indigenous literary futurities with an exciting special guest who will introduce himself shortly. But the second is that tonight is the kickoff of CITR's Fun Drive, and our show falls on that kickoff. So I'm going to give you the rundown of what Fun Drive is. So CITR is a nonprofit and non-commercial station. All DJs are volunteers, and CITR has been operating since 1937, gaining its FM license in 1982. It's home to Discorder Magazine, the longest-running independent culture magazine in Vancouver. And Fun Drive is a week-long fundraiser that happens every year to fund the operating costs of the station and the magazine. This includes equipment upgrades and maintenance, staff costs, and training tools for our volunteers. This year, from February 6th, that's tonight, to 14th, next Friday, we are asking our community to show their support in the form of monthly or one-time donations. The theme this year is a crush on CITR because the final event is on Valentine's Day. So show that you have a crush on CITR and give us a donation. So you can give a donation at citr.ca/donate or call the following number, 604-822-8648. That's 604 UBC unit. But with that, I am happy to introduce our guest, Dr. Dallas Hunt.
Hi.
Hello. Would you like to introduce yourself or say hello?
Sure, yeah. Dansunita Temtek, Dallas Hunt Nitsukasan, Neo Minehio Egwa Wapasusupi Otsunia. So, hi everyone, my name is Dallas Hunt. I'm Cree and a member of Swan River First Nation, which is in Treaty 8 territory in northern Alberta, Canada. I didn't know Sage was also from Treaty 8, so that's something I just discovered. And yeah, I'm a professor here at the University of British Columbia in the English department, primarily focusing on Indigenous literature.
Awesome. We're really excited to be with you tonight. All three of us have had a class with you, so let's get that out of the way there. Learned a lot, discussed a lot, but it's exciting to talk about some of these themes. Brandy, do you want to start us off?
Yeah, so I guess my first question is, you teach English, but you're a Cree learner as well. So what role do our languages have in the future, and how does your language acquisition change the world around you?
Wow, that's a good question right at the gate. Yeah, so I'm constantly trying to become fluent in Cree, mostly for selfish reasons. I want to have a conversation with my kukum before she passes in Cree or something along those lines. I want to continually work on things like vocabulary and, as Brandy was saying, language acquisition. And so this is an ongoing process. I'm not fluent by any means, but it's something I work on sort of daily. And really, it's interesting to think or attempt to think in a different language. I mean, there's this sort of idea out there that our languages are dead, gone, long vanished, or that they're static, never changing. And I think there's a lot of things in Cree especially that sort of point to a sort of futurity. Sometimes I'll like do a tweet and I'll say Cree word of the day, you know, that kind of thing. And I've had people come at me and be like, I did one for Black Panther once, and someone was like, what, how is this the case? Like, the Cree didn't encounter any Black Panthers. And I was like, yeah, but it's a living language. And just like in English or any other language, you would have to have some sort of adaptation or ability to talk about the world around us. Cree can do that work, right? And so those are some of the things that I'm sort of invested in, where my priorities are in terms of how I think about the future through Cree. I think that everything from just how you conjugate a verb in Cree is radically different than sort of romantic languages, right? So I don't know. This is a common thing that's brought up a lot of common trope, but in Cree, when you're going to conjugate a verb, usually you're finding out whether or not the noun is animate or inanimate, right? Which then puts you, I think, in a different relation or a different relationship to these nouns, whereas, you know, in French or what have you, it's whether or not this table is gendered and all these other things. So Cree, I think, gets us to start thinking about, you know, life, death, and our sort of relation to these different objects that we inhabit a world with.
I was going to say, I follow you on Twitter, and my favorite is the Baby Yoda.
Oh, yeah. See, cool.
Yeah, really good, really good. Yeah, Brenny, you had another.
Yeah, so I have a second question for you. Your writing has a firm sense of place. I can see and feel Treaty 8 and Alberta in general in a lot of your writing when I read or hear it. How do you imagine your homelands changing in the future for the better and for the worst? How do these projections inform your writing?
Yeah, I mean, coming from Treaty 8, we're sort of implicated in a lot of the stuff that's going on all over the country in many different ways. So, for instance, what's going on with Wet'suwet'en is directly tied to Treaty 8 in many ways, right? And so we have faced a variety, and a variety of different nations have faced resource extraction and development sort of continually for decades. Nearby where I'm from, they built a massive waste treatment center. It's the Swan Hills Waste Treatment Center. And really what that did was it decimated a lot of our sort of ceremonial hunting grounds, a lot of our sort of medicine grounds where we could actually, you know, engage in these sort of land-based practices. And these environments, these geographies, are under constant threat of just, in many ways, like annihilation in terms of their, when they clear cut in our territories, when they erect these sort of death-delivering sort of resource extraction or development projects, it really does a lot to our kin. It really does a lot to how we can even think about inhabiting places like that. I think there are sometimes, one thing I encounter a lot is in a lot of the land back sort of narrative or rhetoric that's out there, which I like, obviously. But how do we return to our lands when they're poisoned, right? And so this is something that I'm constantly sort of working through. And in terms of how I see the territories I come from sort of influencing my writing, I just like to get at sort of these like everyday Cree economies that circulate. So I like to just sort of privilege or prioritize, you know, some of the things I really liked growing up. And sometimes that was like a Highgard mini pizza sub. And I want people to know like what that meant, right? Like the stakes of getting one of those subs. And yeah, so I like to sort of, I like to focus on the ongoing violences that have implications and effects on other Indigenous nations and communities and that we have to be attentive to, I think, as people from Treaty 8. And then I also like to look at the, you know, sort of effaced or erased narratives of, like, Indigenous peoples actually enjoying things, experiencing things like joy and love and life generally. So I'm constantly navigating these sort of two tensions, and they come up in my writing a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, I think that, like, especially for, like, settler writers, or even I do it sometimes, like, they talk about writing as if it's extractive. Like, people say they're mining for material. Like, even the words we use for writing are extractive instead of generative, which I think is really interesting when it comes to, like, Indigenous writers and writing. Like, how are we not extractive, like, of our own experiences in our writing? which is a really difficult question. I'm not expecting you to answer it. So, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is a question. I mean, y'all have been in a class of mine, and I fall into those, like, word choices too, right? And especially in English, where we're constantly engaging in close reading. I'm like, how do we mine the text for all these different meanings? And as soon as I use that language, I'm like, oh, no. Like, I don't want to reproduce that sort of language. And that isn't what we should be doing to these indigenous texts, I think. We should be engaging more relationally, perhaps, and not just being like, oh, I need to extract, you know, all this meaning and the right meaning and all of these things. Have a sort of mastery over a text, which I think is sort of an impossibility in many ways.
I'm going to take this opportunity to talk a little bit more about Fun Drive. I promise we're going to get back to the good stuff. And then we're going to take a short break for a little bit of a song. But we will have more with Dallas Hunt after I tell you more about Fun Drive. So the reason that we're able to be having this awesome conversation with Dallas and for us to have this show in general and bring Indigenous content to airwaves and to listeners via the website, is because of CITR. So if you want to support and continue to support the Indigenous Collective, please check out the website, citr.ca/donate, or you can give a call and talk to a lovely student who will happily take your donation, 604-822-8648. I'm going to do that one more time, 604-822-8648. And this is ongoing all week, so you can donate all week. I'm just going to take a quick break here, and we're going to hear a little bit Facebook drama. Here you go.
Hey, 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 hey
We're back. So now we're going to move sort of into real futurities and talk a little bit, I hope I don't embarrass you, about your written work.
It's fine.
Yeah. I'm not sucking up, I promise. So in your essay, In Search of Our Better Selves, Totem Transfers, Narratives, and Indigenous Futurities, you quote Lou Cornum with the following. In the colonial imaginary, Indigenous life is not only separate from the present time, but also out of place in the future, a time defined by the progress of distinctively Western technology. If colonial society cannot accept Geronimo in a Cadillac, it can hardly conceive of him in a spaceship. That is from the Space Indian Star Map. But I would love to open up a conversation about what this quote means to you and the ways it engages with notions of progress and technology.
Yeah, I mean, I think first off, Lou Cornum's work generally like slaps. Like it's just really good.
Bonafide.
And they were actually a friend of mine. They did their master's over here. Still are. Like I encounter them at conferences and just love that work, that piece especially in the New Inquiry. And all of Lou's work generally in the New Inquiry is really good. So if you haven't listened to it, I 100% encourage you to check it out. In terms of the quote itself, I think it's very evocative in the sense of it gets us to start thinking about or imagining where we see not only Indigenous life, but sort of Indigenous collective life, right? In my work, I'm trying to work on a manuscript right now that really grapples with a lot of like recent sci-fi sort of speculative future films, whether that's the horror genre, the superhero genre, all of these different sorts of sci-fi films where there's this sort of engagement with indigeneity, but it's only sort of partial, right? It's like we're going to signify indigeneity or code things as indigenous, and yet we're going to do that just to get us to a particular space, which is that space is basically the eradication of anything resembling Indigenous collective social or political life. So when we think about like progress and technology and all these things, there's this constant idea that Indigenous peoples are antithetical to like technology, right? Which is ridiculous. I'm in a room with a bunch of Indigenous peoples and there's computers everywhere, things that I wouldn't even know how to operate like in any capacity. But there's technology present all the time, right? And you hear this sort of, I think when Indigenous peoples make critiques, people are like, well, you know, yeah, sure, colonialism may have been bad, but there's roads now and you have an iPhone, so what does that mean? And it's like, well, we inhabit this earth too. We have to navigate these technologies, but it doesn't necessarily foreclose from thinking about these sort of radical futures where we're not like dependent upon the continual exploitation of people and lands and resources and all of these things, right? I think there's a way in which Indigenous peoples are sort of foreclosed from being in the future or being a part of a future. And so in some of my critical work, what I'm sort of arguing against is precisely that, that I think Indigenous people are going to be in the future. They're in the future now. And I project that, you know, we'll continue on because we've gone through a lot of stuff and weathered it. I think that it sort of equips us in a way to really start to imagine things differently, hopefully, and to really think about how we're going to use technology in a way that sort of not just betters Indigenous people, but in many ways all people. I don't want to put the burden on Indigenous people, but when you look at something like Wet'suwet'en, for instance, which is, I think, on everyone's minds, this mm-hmm. is there's a direct sort of tie here to the future itself, right? It's sort of staking a claim to the future, which is if this project goes through, we're all going to be facing something in really not that far down the line, which is going to be a sort of cataclysmic sort of ecological event that might doom us all, right? And so these land defenders are really staking a claim, I think, to the future. And the present is really trying to foreclose on that claim, just eradicate it entirely, right?
Mm-hmm. That kind of segues us into my question, which is last semester in your English class, we watched Mad Max, and we used the film to discuss, critically analyzed, the conversation of indigenous futurisms. Could you explain why you chose Mad Max for the discussion?
Yeah, I mean, Mad Max is one of those films that I, like, fully will say that I actually like as a film. I think that it's interesting, the stunt work is incredible, and it has these really interesting shots. Everything about that film is interesting in some capacity. That said, I found that it was hailed as this sort of progressive, just sort of accomplishment. I think that year, for an action sci-fi film, it's very interesting because it had the most Oscars out of any film, I think, nominated that year, the most Oscar nominations. And so I think that really spoke to it. There's a particular zeitgeist there that I think Mad Max was sort of this film that had all these sort of action masculinist tropes but was sort of inverting them through this action, primarily, like, Charlize Theron, for instance, being, like, in the driver's seat for a lot of these, like, action sequences and stuff like that. And I think what sort of went unnoticed in the film is that I think it's just sort of chock full of these tropes of indigeneity throughout, and I think they're very explicit. I think sometimes I remember talking to people about this paper I wanted to write is about Mad Max, and I think there's this community that is coded as indigenous, and people would be like, I think you're thinking too much into this kind of thing, which happens a lot to me, I think. But I also was like, I think it fits. Like, Charlize Theron in that film is, like, from the tribe Swatteldog, right? And there's just this mystical group of, I can't remember what they're called, which is weird because I write about it, but they're called...
you can look it up in your... probably got your paper open.
Yeah,
in
the article I write about it. But yeah, there's this group of people that are intimately tied with the land, and they care about the land, and they have with them this sort of... these seeds with them that they carry. And this, I think, is a pretty stark sort of metonym for the land itself, right? They're seeds. And so I was reading through some scholars that were talking about these things called totem transfer narratives, which is this sort of transaction that happens between indigenous peoples and settlers, whereby a sort of item is given. It's like a sort of transaction. An indigenous group or person gives this item. And usually what it signifies, or it's a sort of metonym for the larger sort of land itself, right? So in bequeathing this item, basically, these indigenous peoples are giving the land to settlers, right? They then become autochthonous because they are the sort of rightful inheritance of this land. Now, they're being given it freely, right? And this occurs throughout Canadian literature. All your faves, or they might not be your faves if you listen to this program, but, you know, Margaret Atwood and all these other, like, massive can lit people have deployed this sort of trope to their own ends. And I just found it really weird that it was in this massive film, and it completely adheres to that transactional element, right? It is a totem transfer narrative. And so I start to think about, well, what does it mean when you see these settler colonial tropes they're sort of pervasive, and they start to infiltrate sort of these quote-unquote progressive films, right? Films that I think more than other films, because they have this label of progressive behind them, are sort of sometimes just accepted as, you know, good or great, or sort of films to champion, especially in terms of how they depict particular battles with power and all these things. So I really wanted to, I think people do a lot of good analytical work, but they constantly elide indigenous peoples. And so that was my thing, saying, no, indigeneity's all over this film. And that's why we watched it in class.
I was just thinking about Parasite, not really in the same. Have you seen Parasite?
Yeah.
I I want to see a paper. I want someone to write a paper about the indigenous, like, aspects of that film.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I watched it and then I was like, well, this is interesting. It's like Korean film. And so, I mean, there's still U.S. bases, I think, in Korea from, you know, decades, old conflicts and stuff like this. But I remember reading the director saying that, of course, this family would be interested in this particular sort of like one-dimensional imagery because they're not used to looking at things with complexity. And it was really a sort of nuanced take from a person removed from this context, right, in terms of, you know, I don't think a lot of like settler directors would have even thought about this as like a, or I don't know, that new Quentin Tarantino film is just chock full of Westerns, and it's just given that this is like a cool thing that we should embrace and that these characters are cool. And I think that was like one of the most reactive films I've watched in a very long time. So it's really refreshing in some instances to see somebody say these people don't appreciate complexity and it's precisely because they're incredibly wealthy and don't care about the poor. But that said, it's still kind of weird.
Yeah.
I want to think through it more.
Yeah. Does anyone have a conversation or a question after? Or do we want to break for a song?
Or do you want to do the song? So do you think mainstream fantasy and sci-fi movies and TV shows are akin to what Westerns were in the 20th century? And how do mainstream fantasy and sci-fi series such as Marvel movies maintain the status quo?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I mean, there was a particular project, I think, in mind in terms of a lot of early American and Canadian literature is really about establishing a particular identity, right? And usually doing it in contradistinction to, so the U.S. is going to do it in contrast to, you know, the British as they're sort of creating their own settler colonial society. And Canada's the weirdest because it's constantly trying to navigate between the British and the U.S., right? So then they adopt this rhetoric of strong, hardy men of the North kind of thing, right? And this is going to dominate this literature, mostly in the early sort of beginnings of Canadian literature as it becomes a sort of a discipline or field of study. In terms of modern fantasy, I think there are several things going on, right? There are those films that invest in these tropes and sort of reify them or reproduce them ad nauseum uncritically and don't really think about, you know, indigenous peoples or black communities or all these different peoples that will be actually, I think, in many ways, like, materially affected by, you know, these images, like, circulating unproblematically. But there's also a bunch of great indigenous futurists or indigenous artists and activists and writers that are actually conjuring worlds that are different than the status quo or the worlds we inhabit now, right? So in my classes, I show this film by Dennis Goulet called Wakening, and I really like that film because I think it sort of starts to gesture towards a world that is different. I don't think it's a coincidence that a lot of indigenous writers are writing about the future or thinking about the future or writing about different worlds because we want to see a different world and we want to inhabit a different world, right? My favorite quote from that Lou Cornum piece is actually Lou quoting, I think, Octavia Butler, which is, there's nothing new under the sun, but there might be new suns, right? And I think that's what indigenous futurists are thinking about and asking us to sort of orient ourselves towards is, what are these new suns? How can we exist differently and outside of these problematic tropes?
We're going to continue the conversation after a quick song break and then a word about a fun drive. Woohoo! We're fist bumping. We're getting excited in here. Here we go with a little Tribe Called Red.
Okay, sit on my way now.
Okay, we are back, and we're here to talk about Fund Drive. So this year's Fund Drive goal is $30,000. So we cannot do that without your help, but you won't be doing it without reward. So not only will you continue to get great radio programming, you will also get some swag. So if you pledge $30 or $5 a month, you get a customized CITR and Discorder Fund Drive candy hearts. So that's nice and sweet, pun intended. If you pledge $60 or $10 a month, you get Don't Talk to Me Until I've Had My Discorder mug. They're very bright pink. They're really nice. and the candy hearts. If you pledge $101.9 or $15 a month, you get a CITR toque, a song dedication on Valentine's Day. So if you have a honey, you can do that. Discorder, Fund Drive, hearts, and the mug. I'll keep going, but I'm going to leave you on the edge with this, and I'll continue this list because there's lots. But I think we have another question for Dr. Dallas Hunt.
Hello, Dr. Dallas Hunt. This is Brandy again. How does the future factor into thinking about the present, and can futurisms fail the present?
Yeah, I think this is a good question, and I have this question, or this discussion, I should say, with a lot of my other like Indigenous colleagues and stuff, which is mostly because I think we are, as communities, constantly oriented towards the future, towards the present, because we have to be vigilant in terms of what's going on, right, at all times. And I think we're seeing a lot of that now, but we see it all the time. But I think what sort of happens here, or the way I try to describe it to people who sometimes say to me somewhat dismissively, like, why are you thinking about the future? It's the present. It's the here and now. We need to really start to really engage with this. And this is where all of our actions and sort of thoughts and imaginaries and orientations, where it should be invested in. And I sort of just like to phrase it like, I don't think it's an either or thing, right? I think you can do, Sarah Hunt calls this sort of both and work, which is just, we can be oriented towards the present and constantly striving to be vigilant in terms of settler state encroachment or bodily material harm, all of these things, all of the constant sort of violence that the state perpetuates against Indigenous peoples. But I think it's also a worthwhile endeavor to hold that in one hand and then start to think about what our horizons are, right? What our future horizons are, because I think sometimes what can happen, and I'm not trying to generalize too much, is if we're too stuck in the present, then it becomes a process of, well, we know what it is that we need to do, and we're just not going to think outside of the frames that have been sort of established. And I think what we need to do is start to think about how these frames come to be established and sort of sedimented over time, and how they can be quite harmful, I think, sometimes to our communities as well, right? And one of these terms that is wielded, I think, in a harmful way at times can be this notion of tradition, right? If you're not being traditional in this or that way, then you're doing something wrong, and therefore, you know, some sort of regulative thing is going to happen to you. And I think what thinking about the future differently allows us to do is actually sometimes critically not only examine the present but also the past a bit and say, well, if we're going to be invested in these processes that don't offer or provide liberation for all of our community, then why are we doing this work? It might be because we're limited by these frames of the here and now, right? And we can't even begin to speculate about what a just future looks like or what freedom actually looks like, right? And so I think doing both processes is really important work. And I don't begrudge anybody focused on the now, because there's a lot going on in the now. But I also think that sort of future speculative work is important too.
I know, it gives me a lot of hope. I feel like if I just focused on what was going on around me, I would never make it past my door. do you have any recommendations for speculative work, or that you've mentioned a couple that you've connected with in the past, but that give you that sort of sense of being able to do duality between present and future?
Oh, yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. There's a lot of great work out there. So my class, few sort of futurist texts we've been reading recently has been, so last term we looked at Dennis Gillette's short film. I've mentioned Dennis already. We read a short story by Gwen Benaway. Chelsea Vowell and Molly Swain are constantly thinking about the future in ways that are just incredible to me. They're two Métis thinkers that are doing really incredible, important work. Joshua Whitehead, of course, is doing a lot of interesting, incredible futurist work. There's just a whole slew of great writers that I'm, constantly trying to read at all opportunities. And there's a lot coming out. So, it's about being sort of vigilant in terms of keeping up with these works, but there's so much great work out there.
This is sort of like unrelated, but okay. Related in that there it's like always interesting to talk about this. How do you think treaty and treaties will impact the future?
Yeah, these questions are hard.
Sorry, I
gave you a soft toss there, yeah. And then that one was a...
No, I think that's a really important, great question. I mean, so I've been talking about this recently, actually, with a few students in my... I'm teaching a class right now. It's post-D in anti-colonial theory. And we're starting to think about... what are some forms of relating or even governance or whatever term you want to use? But if we want to talk about something like the end of settler colonialism, which I think some people strive for as a sort of idea, as a concept, that would radically change the way we relate to one another, right? And the way that settler colonialism structures the way we relate to each other now, and usually it's asymmetrically in all these different sort of myriad ways. And so one thing that some people have sort of pointed to or gestured to as a roadmap as to how we might think about relating to each other after the, dismantling of something like settler colonialism is through forms of treaty making, right? I mean, treaty making, especially with the numbered treaties and the modern treaty process, has largely been dictated by an interpretation by the state, right? The settler colonial nation state will only interpret treaties through a particular way, and it's usually almost always 100% to their benefit. But indigenous peoples were making treaties long before settler states got here, before the Canadian state started its sort of state-making violent processes. Communities and nations were making treaties with one another, and they actually make treaties now. I think I read something where the Haida and Haisla just had a recent treaty which had nothing to do with the state, right? So as a sort of form of diplomacy or sort of engagement, it's can be a useful way to start to think about, well, if we're just given the future or the sort of like... sort of open canvas that can be the future, how might we think about how relations are sort of organized or structured in a way that is sort of non-hierarchical and sort of doesn't result in these asymmetrical violences? And sometimes these notions of treaty or treaty making could be one of many paths or one of many ways of thinking about how we might exist in the future in relation to other peoples.
You handled it well. That was good. That was good. Well, I would love to ask you, as sort of a concluding-ish conversation, if you could let us know what you're working on, what you're thinking about, or what you're actually practically and physically writing about, where your sort of mind is going these days.
Yeah. So right now I have a few things coming up and I'm working on. So I worked on a book with my colleague Gina Starblanket, and it's called Storing Violence, Unraveling the Colonial Narratives of the Stanley Trial. And what that was we wrote a Globe and Mail article after the acquittal of Gerald Stanley and the killing of Colton Bushi. And we were approached by a press to extend that article. And as that was going on, we also saw this book by Kent Roach come out. And it was a book that came out incredibly quickly, rapidly, and the family was completely unaware of its production, you could say. And so they were sort of taken aback by this Roach book. I remember hearing about it from Jade Tatusis, who was Colton Bushi's brother, or sorry, sister and cousin. Colton was her brother. And I just remember getting a message from her being like, do you know this person? Like, do you know this book? And I went to his talk at the University of Manitoba. And he had done all this work, and he knew the trial very well, and but in no way had contacted the family. So what we wanted to do with this book was have the family be involved at every step of the process and to make sure any royalties from the book go to the family particularly, and to really sort of present or really provide for people. It's a very readable book, and it really speaks to the narratives that sort of underpinned that whole thing, because there's a lot of racist rhetoric that was circulating in Saskatchewan, but throughout the prairies and Canada more broadly. And we wanted to say these aren't just neutral narratives that you just arrived at, that there's a history here, right? How these narratives, you know, persist through time. So that's what that book is concerned with. And I believe that comes out in May. I have an edited collection of Anishinaabe poet Kateri Akawenzi-Dam coming out in the near future. So I've been working with Kateri to basically have a book of all of her works. And that's been really fun because it's collaborative and I've been doing a lot of collaborative stuff. I have a book of poetry coming out, not till 2021, but I'm interested and terrified about that project because usually I write in sort of an academic register, which allows me a little bit of space, but poetry sometimes can be really immediate. And there's some stuff I write about in that collection that's incredibly personal to me. And so I just imagine people where I'm from reading it and then being like, ooh, I'm getting some goss here. There's some, So yeah, that's coming out. I have a children's book out called The Wasis and the World Famous Bannock that if you want to read it, it's meant for the acquisition of Cree language, especially for Cree children and speakers. But if other Indigenous peoples are interested in the book, all the royalties to that go to my cook'ems. So if you want to line my cook'ems pockets, please do. And one of the things I want to get across in that book is that it's about language acquisition, but all of the relations that Awasis is engaged in that text are non-hierarchical and non-extractive relationships. And so that I'm hoping that's a theme that just persists throughout my work.
I'm going to go buy that book. I want your cook'em to be doing well.
Yeah, me too.
I have a question. How do you make your writing accessible to everyone? So like I'm in a FNAS course, it's for writing, and one of our topics this week was audience. So how do you write accessibly for an audience, and how do you choose your audience?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, and it's a constant struggle, right? So I think some publishing houses or just print places have audience in mind sort of from the jump. So they'll be like, can you write this, but just sort of get rid of all the jargon that you're sort of steeped in, which I think for academics can be kind of hard, right? Because we're just constantly inundated with sort of jargon. And I have two approaches to this, one of which is that I do generally, just for me as a reader, I like my work to read well. Like I want it to read when I'm reading it for it to be clear. And I'm not into notions of bullying the reader. That said, I don't think that all hard texts do that, right? I think some texts are, in many ways, have to be difficult because what they're speaking to is a difficult thing to either articulate or disentangle. And so a lot of my formative reading practices and writing practices have come from engaging with those texts that are just so difficult and like you bang your head against the wall and you're just like, and you have to read it for hours or you revisit it. And So I do think there's a value in sometimes encountering those kinds of texts. And I also worry that sometimes we don't give a lot of credit to our audiences. I try to navigate this sort of the presumption that the people that we're writing to or for or about or in relation to cannot understand the works. And I don't know, sometimes I'll send like snippets of what I'm writing to like my mom who, you know, didn't graduate high school and, you know, but is like a voracious sort of thinker and reader and will just be like, you know, can give me that harsh Cookham vibe that I need sometimes and be like, well, let's cut through this. And like, what are you trying to say here? And some of the stuff I'm writing is jargon heavy or, you know, can be somewhat hard to read, I think, for me personally, but she can cut to the quick. And I always have that in my mind too, which is that I think our communities are incredibly smart and intelligent and know things intuitively at times too, right? So they can, even while not engaging in the jargon, get the crux of a writing or a piece, and then just can really give you some no-nonsense like sort of responses to it. So I'm just constantly, I think like most writers, trying to navigate that at all points and being a little more, I don't want to say obtuse, but I guess sort of the writing be a little more obscure when it has to be, when I'm trying to articulate something that I'm working through that I believe is difficult. But then I also write children's books where the language is as plain as it can be, and I want it to be that way because I want children to read it, and the most important part there is the Cree, right? So I appreciate the question. I always have audiences. I'm always thinking about it, and I don't think I have a perfect answer, but navigating it is what I would say.
Navigating it, a common theme in most most of our conversations here at Unseated. I am going to begin to wrap up the episode just by reminding our listeners about Fun Drive before I do the most important thing, which is thank our guest tonight. But I just want to reiterate that Fun Drive is going on until next Friday, the 14th. Lots of fun programming on the station, lots going on. There's events. Check us out on Facebook or on the website, and you can donate at citr.ca/donate or by calling 604-822-8648. I'm going to hand it over to Brandy to close us off on the web. On the episode, but I just wanted to thank Dr. Dallas Hunt for joining us today and having a great conversation with us. Brandy, please close us off.
So before we go, I encourage everyone listening to follow Gedimetan Checkpoint on Instagram. That's Gedimetan Checkpoint for updates on the violent and unacceptable arrests and seizure of land on Wet'suwet'en territory. And to go to the rally, I think they're meeting at Hastings and Clark to close the Port of Vancouver again tomorrow from 3 to 6. I believe there are people even staying the night there. And to show up for the rally on Sunday as well. Yeah, please do that. And thank you, Dallas Hunt.
Dr. Dallas Hunt.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
All right, have a great rest of your Thursday night. Here is Jingle Dress Side Stop.